gonna have the news.
It is Tuesday, July 12th.
That this just feels so weird.
I know. Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
Pretend it's Monday.
It's Tuesday.
Oh, it's Monday in your heart.
It's a summer Tuesday. That's basically Monday.
This is a special episode of LA Podcast. I am your host, Alyssa Walker. I'm here with Scott Frazier and Rachel Riz. It is so good to see you both.
I haven't seen either of you in a while, my birthday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
your birthday. Alyssa, you brought me ice cream when I was... Actually, that's not true. I saw you after the election, but you brought me ice cream when I was sick. I didn't see you, though.
And we had like a little girls' night.
We did.
Yeah, it was very fun.
We have talked, but not recorded it.
Uh-huh.
And
that we know
imagine.
Of.
Yeah. A world
it
without
is
podcasts.
Los Angeles.
Conversations are happening and
wires.
No tape recorders are present.
The FBI could be listening.
You never know.
At any time.
True.
Well, speaking of that, Los Angeles, it's been 5 weeks since
if you're within 50 feet of any elected official in Los Angeles, you are being covertly recorded.
The chances are quite high. It's been 5 weeks since the primary election, exactly, which has now been certified after what you could call a roller coaster of takes.
You could call it that.
A lot of ups and downs. So we got together because we really want to talk through what's happened in the last few weeks in our fair city. But first, I know it's been a while since you've heard from us. It's been taking a little longer to make the changes for the show that we promised you, and we are still working on it. And we have paused the Patreon payments. We appreciate everyone checking in, sending messages. Those of you who took our audience survey, thank you so much for that. So helpful. We'll have more to say about it soon, I promise. Just thank you for your ongoing support. We really do appreciate it. In the meantime, should we tell some LA stories?
Yeah, let's do it. Dust off the LA story muscle. You want to go first?
I can go first. You want me to? I mean, mine is so timely.
And
feel free to ask me questions about it. But I went to the opening of the 6th Street Viaduct.
Uh-huh.
And this has been a hotly...
They couldn't just call it a bridge? That's my first question.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like, what does viaduct even infer to you? It means a multimodal situation, right?
I don't know. I'd start thinking about like Roman chariots.
Yeah. I think about water for some
reason. Oh, you want it? Okay, aqueducts. Well, yeah, I can tell you there's no water on this bridge or under it.
Chariot races, that's what I think.
Chariot race. Okay, well, that I would like to see more of that. Yeah, I thought a viaduct meant like it was like, you know, also had a train or something like that on it, or rail or something. I don't know. But this is primarily a bridge that looks and functions almost exactly the same as it did the one that was torn down to build it, which you, as you remember, had like a, what they called a concrete cancer, where there was a chemical reaction with the silica in the sand that was used to make it originally. So it was basically falling apart. We needed to replace it. It took much longer than it should have. And I think this bridge is like an artifact of like maybe what we thought a bridge should look like in like the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And it is in no way an improvement.
Well,
from what it should look like
in terms of what, like the allocation of space,
even the aesthetics of it, the materials. I mean, there will be a park.
I said it looks like a swoopy freeway.
Swoopy free. I mean, that's what it is. I think I was prepared for it to be like very different from a freeway overpass, and the whole time I was like, I am in a freeway overpass the entire time. And there's going to be a park beneath it. There'll be this really nice park in a year or so beneath it. I mean, it's not finished. I'd have to say, like, there was like construction fences up, there's like loose bolts.
Are they calling it finished? Like,
well, I don't know.
They had an opening party.
Yeah, we keep having these opening parties for things that aren't
rolling
done.
Parties I've seen.
We also had one for the Crenshaw line this week that was like not really done, but we cut ribbons.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think
not done, and also you cannot access it from both sides.
I'm not sure. We'll see what happens. It was very weird. To the official opening, you could only come on the Boyle Heights side.
Mm-hmm. It's and the bridge halfway to nowhere.
It's great for, you know, parties, which is weird because that's what they are saying. Like all the messaging that came out since it's been completed is like, this is going to be a great event space for the city. Okay, then why did we have to?
Yeah, why are we doing this?
Why didn't we make that type of space? There's literally a bridge a block away.
Right.
And there is another bridge like two blocks away.
It's half a parking lot and yes. half event space.
Yes. And I think that it will open. We're recording this on Sunday. It will open the rest of the way and you can go judge it for yourself. But to me, it was just pretty disappointing that we basically just put back what was there without making any fundamental effort to change the experience, which is very hot. Very far.
It's
sunny.
Yeah, it's a very brutal sort of structure. Very brutalist. Right?
Yeah, and then the big contested question was like these that you have this nice heavy barrier to protect pedestrians from the very fast moving cars. They will be very fast moving. I don't think that will change either.
Uh-huh. Swoopy freeway.
But swoopy freeway. But there's these rubber stoppers, little rubber curb, black rubber curbs. We don't have anything like it on streets right now in LA.
Yeah.
And then the same old bollards that if you kick them too hard, as my children were trying to do, or just slightly back over them with a car, they will just topple right over. So we have like no real protection.
Yeah.
And the
rubber
bad.
Bumpers are not going to stop a
no,
car.
No, people they're actually designed for cars to pull over them. It said on the official Twitter account for cars to go and park in the bike lane if they are like the car needs to stop on the bridge. Which
right,
to
if
me,
they need a selfie, emergency selfie.
So that part is disappointing, but those things also look really bad. Like if you want it to look like this, like sweeping
the bridge of the future
like oh like those are it's just
the bridge of the future of 2011.
That's exactly, but even in 2011, like the High Line, it's not like we didn't try to do things differently,
right?
Mm-hmm. The High Line was beautiful, you know, opening and being built and during this time, and it was in people's minds. So like, why we couldn't have made this into an actual great space for these two neighborhoods instead of sticking a park underneath it.
Right.
And just basically saying, cars, keep going fast. We got you.
It is embarrassing. And also the fact that like we have either kept the same amount of traffic throughput or increased it on this bridge, like four cars, when this bridge has been gone now for I don't even know how many years.
The world has gone on.
And it did not matter. Yes. It didn't matter at all.
It could have been.
You definitely could have made this like a lower capacity bridge that was with more space given over to making it not a concrete hellhole.
A true viaduct.
But there's just like, you know, nostalgia for the old Sixth Street Bridge, and it has to look and feel like the old one, which was a concrete nightmare. I mean, I don't know.
They like, succeeded there.
It succeeded there, yes. We have replicated the feeling of baking alive on pavement.
Yeah, as we did so well for all those decades before.
It's our main...
Anyway, it looks pretty lit up at night.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
Okay, that's
so
good.
So maybe go check
The events
check
will
it
be
out.
Beautiful
yeah,
at
the
night.
Events will be... they could change the colors of the lights to like how they do with City Hall.
Ooh, mm-hmm. Love that.
Although with City Hall, they have to physically change the colors of the lights. This one, they do not.
And when the sun goes down every night, it starts playing City of Stars from the movie La La Land. Oscar-winning song. Good. That's fantastic. Rachel, do you have a LA story?
Yes. I was debating several. Like, did I want to do one, you know, from the past couple of months? Do I want to be nostalgic? But yesterday I was on a boat in Long Beach, so ooh. I thought, why not talk about
the big boat or a different boat?
No, we were at London Boat Rentals. This is not sponsored, but I do recommend it because the folks there were great. It was a little 2-hour rented boat ride for my brother-in-law's birthday. Happy birthday, Tommy. And it was so fun. And it only took like an hour to get to Long Beach. Haven't been to Long Beach in many years. Have no business there. But you can rent boats there and bring alcohol and dogs and food onto this boat. And you just kind of float around.
How do the dogs do on the boat?
Well, they just sit there a little scared. But if you have a furry companion that you do not want to leave at home, you can bring them on the boat and you spend the 2 hours like dodging big boats from people who live in Long Beach honking their little boat horns at you. Aww. But overall, it is very relaxing. You're seeing the sights. There's people on kayaks. There's crew teams practicing. Like, it was very nice.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. We should do a trip, I think. But I loved it. I thought it was very fun. And it was a nice way to get out of the city, but still feel like you were there.
Uh-huh. Good way to check in on the supply chain issues at the also port, that, too.
Yeah. I was watching bags of Target goods float by in the water. But it was really fun. It was really relaxing. And you all know I'm not a nature person. I don't really like to go outdoors. But I do love to be on the water, shockingly, for someone who also can't swim. Another fun fact about me. But it was so relaxing and so fun.
I love being on the water.
And they do have water taxis down there that you can kind of get along the coast there using technically I've public transit. Yeah. I mean, ferries and water taxis are not very popular because they're like, I guess they're very environmentally destructive. They're not all electric yet. And they're like, you just see in New York City, they like subsidize it a lot more. They like lied about how much they subsidize it. Like, it's not going to make money or fans, but it's so cool. You're on a boat.
It was just honestly really fun. And it was a nice experience, like outside of LA. And shout out to Long Beach because I forget that it's there sometimes, unless I'm talking about. I don't even know.
Well, that actually sounds like the water taxis sound like a really good way to get from Long Beach to Orange County, like to North Orange County. Yeah. Like, forget that drive. That's terrible.
Well, except they do remind you, like, you literally can't go past this point because then you are in the ocean. So just don't, which was a little scary to think about. If someone fell asleep, we all fell asleep. We all got poisoned. I don't know. You know, my mind, my Virgo mind goes to the extreme. Like, what if something happens and we just end up floating in the ocean?
The dogs will get you back. Yeah. The dogs will rescue you.
You're now the property of the Evergreen Corporation.
Or whoever owns that part of the ocean out there. It's Blue Sky Eno's ocean.
Maersk is taking you back to Sweden. Wow, that sounds great. I would love to do that. I've never actually been out of that harbor, although like San Diego, or not San Diego, San Pedro and some other ports around here. Always fun to go out on the water. I love it. My LA story, it would be so great to not have this be it, but I guess it has to be that I got COVID.
Not as fun as a boat.
No, it wasn't fun. the entire month of June was just kind of a disgusting mess for me. I hated every inch of it. The last 4 weeks was sick for, I want to say, maybe 3.5 of them.
Oh my gosh.
And only now like getting better. I had COVID. When it went away, I got sick again. And I don't know whether it was just a continuation of COVID symptoms or if it was a cold because my immune system is just wrecked from 2 years of pandemic. Either way, it was very much just a challenge to like get out of bed every day and be like, damn, I can't wait until I feel even a semblance of normalcy come back. The way I got COVID was going down to a wedding, of course. Society's favorite super spreader events. And that was for two dear friends of mine. It was a beautiful, beautiful wedding. But we came back and then we celebrated Aunesis's victory in CD1, which we're going to talk a lot more about, and gave COVID to a lot of friends, which was sad because obviously we have to have a separate group chat where everyone who is sick is talking about how bad they feel, and it is our fault.
Society
abdication of duty on many people's behalf.
It's the system, man. But anyway, you know, now feeling a lot better and happy to be up and moving around. just in time to, I don't know, in theory, get Omicron all over again.
Yeah, as you can just get it right away now. As the
news is. So BA4 and BA5, baby.
There was, you know, the most challenging part about that was Ida got COVID, which was really scary for about a day and a half, my 11-month-old daughter. And she recovered so fast, but the first day that she got sick, she had a huge fever. Kaiser recommended that we bring her into the emergency room, so we did that. And then she started throwing up everywhere in the waiting room. So that was extremely scary. Anyone who's done it before will know having a young child sit on one of the like ER hospital beds is just like a really frightening thing to do because they just are so tiny and they have all these things hooked up to them. And she recovered really fast, honestly. Once we were able to get her fever down, she was back to normal within about a day or two, which was great for her. A little bit harder for Sarah and me because we were both still bedridden and she just wanted to like get up and play. Yeah.
Oh man.
All in all, quite difficult. Anyone who tells you that it is just a cold, I would say no, not quite accurate. Plus, you know, now you have the months of being like every time you get sick again, being like, oh, is it long COVID? Is it COVID again? Right. Is it, you know, whatever. Ugh. Not fun, I would say, by any stretch of the imagination. Anyway, so that was June. May it rot in hell. That was a terrible month
down
for me.
With June.
But it's over now.
Yeah, it's over, and there were
and
some...
And everything is great now forever, as the phrase goes.
There were some good things that happened in June. Let's talk about some of them.
To other people.
Okay, so you mentioned Scott... CD1 being a race that things happen to people. Good things happen to other people. This was something I called very early on for anyone who is going to talk to me about this. I have been saying this from the beginning that Sadia would be kicked out in the primary.
Right.
And people doubted me.
Yeah, I was one. Sure. I think the safe choice would have been to say that the incumbent wins in the primary, which obviously lower turnout than the general. And normally, at least, a less progressive electorate than in the general election as well. Alyssa is your woman. If you want to follow somebody who is making predictions... She's like the oracle. You can just go to her and she will always be right. And I, frankly, still will not believe her going forward. that's just the way it goes.
Let's run the numbers really fast because it is quite astonishing, especially when you look at, too, is how much money we're spending some of these races. So the final was 54 to 46. That's about 30,000 votes. And as you remember, and we'll talk about this too in the show, it began when the first round of results dropped. It looked like Sadio had it just from those very early numbers. And people tried to make a bigger deal out of this than they should have.
Mm-hmm.
The way the votes kept coming in. And it flipped almost.
Like the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. The next
two,
dump.
Or 2 days
the next
later.
Dump. Yeah. So the story quickly changed very quickly. Sadio, well, first of all, let's talk about Hernandez. Like, so Scott, tell me just real quickly, like how this got achieved perhaps.
Right. So listeners may remember that we actually had Eunice's Hernandez on as a guest, following, it was either immediately before or immediately after the victory of, Measure J. And we talked to her, you know, she's somebody who has a lot of organizing experience, somebody who was working with La Defensa and was integral to the writing and passage of Measure J, which sought to, at the county level, redirect spending away from the sheriff's department and into social services, although it's had a rather fraught legal path since then, since passing a couple of years ago. Aunesis, she knows this space so well. And that was something that I think we were all really impressed with when we spoke with her, when we talked to her a couple of years ago, was just how well she knows not just the conversations being had, but really also the ins and outs of making policy around social services work better. And I think that attracted from an early point in the race a lot of people on the left. She did draw endorsements from DSA, and she had a campaign that was run in part by Ground Game LA, who have been very active in this particular cycle. There, Megan Choi, who was also one of the former campaign co-chairs for Nithya Raman, also worked with Ground Game to chair this campaign for Aunesis. And what a record. That's an incredible record.
I mean, across the board.
Especially when you compare it to some of the more established career political consultants and campaign voices who struck out big time in this election cycle. Aunesis is somebody who came into the race not shying away from saying that she is a police abolitionist, mm-hmm. which is at least in the mechanisms of city government, still a very fringe position to say that you are in favor of replacing an armed law enforcement model with a model that instead seeks to both deliver services to prevent crime from happening in the first place, and also then to divert people who have committed crimes into services to actually help rehabilitate them, is not something, obviously, that's been embraced by many existing city politicians. Paul Krikorian just spoke to Steve Lopez recently and said that he thinks that everyone who believes that is a dum-dum. That's his exact quote.
We'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, we will. Dum-dum quote. And I think she said that she believes she is the first abolitionist to be on the city council.
I think that's fairly certain.
The first out abolitionist.
Yeah. And talking about spending, of course, what happened was the landlords, the labor, the cops particularly, really poured a lot of money into this race. In particular, some of the mailers that went out against her were disgusting. And there was as a trend that we will see reflected across the city is the candidates that the most particularly the Police Protective Association tried to get into office all actually ended up coming in
second.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting trend that we see.
Yeah, I mean, like to talk a little bit more about the ads, like we were seeing things like, Aunesis Hernandez is going to make sure that you have no cops at your disposal when somebody comes to kill you and your children, which will happen the day after the election. Like the ads were very dire. And all made considerable hay of the fact that, you know, she's an abolitionist, she wants to defund the police, etc. The wisdom within the Democratic Party and almost all of the consultants operating in the space, including the ones hired by the LAPPL, the Police Protective League, are primarily consultants who work with Democrats. But the wisdom, as you might have it, in the party is such that defund the police is toxic. And anybody who says that they don't support cops is dead in the water. And so you really saw that with the advertising. The political messaging was really leaning into both here, and we'll talk about in CD13 as well, a vote for Anissa Hernandez is a vote to like rob yourself. But what we're seeing here is like, so that is based on it's based on an untested suspicion that voters were going to hard reject this idea of defunding the police, reject Black Lives Matter, et cetera. And everything that had happened in 2020 had led to this pushback that was inevitable, a correction, if you will. And now that that idea has been tested, we have to reckon with the possibility that perhaps voters have not done that. Because if you are going so hard in these ads against defund the police or saying Aunesis embraces this, if you're wrong about that calculation, then you're actually spending money to advertise for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just like letting other people know.
Yeah, actually great. Like some of the messaging for a lot of these candidates was like, this sounds great. Like, what are you saying?
So it's a gamble, yeah. right? Like they really went hard on the premise that. Money into
housing? Wow. Like, let's try it.
They really went hard on the premise that voters were going to reject some things that they maybe didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, and to also look at what an exceptional moment this was. This is the third time in 25 years that a challenger has beaten an incumbent in LA. It's been,
and the second time that it's happened in a primary.
Yes,
in the last 25 years.
Yeah, that's right, in the actual primary. And what happened next? We didn't see Cedillo for
weeks on end. He was missing.
Has anybody seen him? I haven't seen him.
He made a statement eventually.
He did make a statement eventually. And he got like
COVID.
Yeah, he got the June COVID like everyone else.
Yep. Okay. He was with Scott sick in bed and finally emerged.
Well, I did do a toast to Gil Cedillo that night, actually. And I guess maybe he was closer than I knew.
Look at God. People got COVID. And he finally, on July 1st, finally conceded. And I was like, why did it take you so long, buddy? Where were you? He was just missing. He wasn't at council.
Yeah, he wasn't coming to council. I guess he was sick, but we weren't told that.
Yeah.
And then even in his statement where he conceded, he did not even mention her.
He didn't even mention his district, basically. It was kind of just like, I think he had the word district in there one time, but it wasn't like, you know, CD1, I'm so happy to have served here or anything like that. It was just like, you know, my political career.
My decades of service. And
blah, blah, blah.
Apparently,
wah, wah, wah.
People who were trying to reach out for statements were not getting responses. Constituents that were reaching out about things, we're also not getting responses from this office. And the staff said that they were so traumatized by the results that they could not even function as an office. Like, I don't understand this part of it. Like, is this what happened? What?
I want to know if my big question is, if that had happened on the other side of town, let's say a couple months ago when Mike Bonin announced that he was retiring. Same exact situation, right? All of those people are about to be out of a job in December.
And
same time frame.
Those people who actually, I would say, were traumatized by the attacks from the people district. Like, they actually faced quite a bit of harassment.
What would the credibility have been if they were like, oh, we just can't do our jobs. We're just going to... we're just so upset about this that we're just going to sit here and coast for
and
the next 10 months.
Bonin didn't show up for any meetings at all for like weeks. Like, can you imagine?
Oh, man, he showed up real fired up. And Cedillo has not done that as yet. Who knows? Yeah. Maybe he will at some point.
Maybe we'll see him this
between
week.
Now and December.
Yeah. So what do you think? That was my next question. What do you think is going to happen between now and December? What do we think is going to happen? Will he show up for his district as...
We could have a moment where he could say, I'm done, and she could start early, just as we've done in a couple of situations before, if he really doesn't want to do it. I don't know.
I do. He won't do that.
That was my feeling, too.
Let me just say, I also would not just forego my whatever enormous paycheck on that $200,000 a year salary for no reason, just to give it to somebody who had beaten me soundly in an election. The question of whether or not he will do his job, now that's a little bit more suspect. I do wonder whether or not there is going to be anything that you could really point to and prove that he has been working between now and December. But we also know that, I mean, so Nery Martinez said that, you know, all of his absences to date had been excused. Eventually he said he had COVID. And, you know, hopefully he recovers well from COVID. Not a fun illness to have, especially at his age. That being said, you would expect that at some point even in his absence, right, the business of the district should be continuing. And if it can't, that sort of goes to the issue, one of the issues for which voters were seeking a replacement.
Right.
I will say, you know, before we move on, the funding aspect of this was really interesting. He did far out earn Aunesis, but he also had a big time advantage.
Yeah.
So like all of the incumbents, because of the fact that they know that they're running for re-election, they can start fundraising much earlier in many cases than their opponents can. Aunesis declared relatively late, so we had a lot of money in Gil's tank. What eventually convinced me that Aunesis was going to, or at least had a good chance of pulling off the win belatedly long after Alyssa called this, was that in the final funding period before the election, Gil's support had basically dried up completely.
That's right.
He had a fraction of what Hernandez's campaign had attracted in funds in the year 2022. The number of donors was paltry. It was like, if you actually eliminate the people who are donating through, you know, full families and mothers-in-law and things like that, you know, he had a few dozen unique donors in the year 2022. It seemed like he was either being given up as a lost cause or just completely failing to energize anyone who might want to keep him in office.
Yeah. And that is exactly what we saw in the opposite in her campaign, which was door knocking, small dollar donations, and just this real energy.
It's the energy, yeah.
Real energy. And then a good thing to talk about next is heading out to a similar thing we saw play out on the West Side. Our West Side correspondent, Rachel.
Yes, back again.
Tell us what happened in CD 11.
Yeah, this was wild. I didn't really know. I didn't make any predictions because I was just very unsure how it was going to play out. Tracy Park was the first person to hop into the race against Mike Bonin. I think it was last June. So before he had even announced.
Oh, right. When they were having the press conferences like on Venice Beach and stuff. Exactly. Right. That era. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. That era of our district. And I had seen quite a few of her signs. Obviously, signs don't vote, but they do tell me that at least a field team of some sorts is out there putting signs up. And I had read some of her emails and felt a little freaked out because she is a scary person, in my opinion. She's very reactionary. Tracy Park is pro-cop. She believes that we don't have enough police. Tracy Park is pro-criminalization of all in-house people. And the media would want you to believe that that is a popular winning message in Mike Bonin's CD 11. Even a lot of like the local press on the West Side in general, all of the local weeklies were very much, you know, talking about smash and grabs and the unhoused populations. And I felt a little scared. Maybe she was going to win. And then we had Aaron Darling pop into the race at the very last second. He was the last candidate of all six people running against Mike Bonin to declare. His campaign had a shoestring budget, a very small field team, and yet still managed to pull out ahead of Tracy Park. So the numbers are Erin Darling at 35% to Tracy Park's 29%. And they are both advancing to November. And Erin has a fairly comfortable lead over her at the moment. And when we look at who he's going to pull votes from, Greg Goods, particularly on Sirius campaign, he's a Garcetti, a friend of Garcetti. I believe those votes are probably going to go to Erin. What's tricky about the West side, though, as we all know and as we all talk about, is that it can lean very moderate and then it can lean a little conservative. And so where are those kind of middle votes going to go? Are those folks going to fully lean into Tracy Park's right-wing Republican attitudes, or are folks going to lean into the progressive side of our district, which does exist? We do have a very solid working class progressive part of our district, and I think we very clearly see that with Erin Darling coming in first place. So that's kind of like the top lines of all of that. But it was remarkable to see. I was thoroughly impressed and obviously very happy that that was the result that we saw.
Yeah, and again, like this, I think we did talk about this back when it was happening, but when Bonin said he wasn't going to run, Greg Good had already kind of been laying the foundation. So mm-hmm. it seemed like everybody had kind of just written off the race as being like, it's going to go to him. Mm-hmm. And then Darling jumped in at the last minute. And really, the again, this remarkable moment of not much time, not much money, mm-hmm. Heavy spending from the other side, especially yes. from the Police Protective League, and pulled it off. And I think this was also surprising for people who've,
yeah,
for people who pay attention to the media, yeah. who made it seem like this district had been written off, right?
The lamestream media. I mean, yeah. I'll include myself in that too. I mean, the thing that was interesting about CD11, and that makes it to me, I mean, you can't discount Aunesis winning in the primary against a sitting city council member. That is obviously the biggest accomplishment of the left in Los Angeles in a number of years. The thing that's really impressive about CD11 is exactly what you said, though, Rachel, is that he was the last candidate in. There wasn't an organization built up around this. There up until partway through this spring, I want to say, there was an expectation that Mike Bonin would be on the ticket. I think he announced his retirement in January or February. And so now we end up with a person who getting actually more than a third of votes in a crowded field. That's a good margin regardless of who you are. If Tracy Park had gotten 35% of the vote, that would have been really an excellent performance given how many people were in this suddenly open seat. Like this was a suddenly contested election. And the fact that it's Erin Darling, who, unlike Tracy Park, did not have all of this money, did not have a year plus in pursuit of the seat, that is, I would say, the next most impressive thing that we have to look at in this cycle, and suggests, hopefully, that there is a solid path to victory there in November. As I said, you know, turnout will be higher. The expectation is that there will be a more progressive electorate as well. I mean, just sort of a side note, I've seen a lot of people on Twitter, especially from the reactionary circles of hell, posting their opinion that, oh, well, this is a low turnout election. Oh, this was also in Steve Lopez's column. Oh, yeah. 7 out of 10 Angelenos did not vote. So this is not necessarily representative of what people want to see. Nobody was that concerned about the unrepresentativeness of like the ideological unrepresentativeness right. of an Eric Garcetti getting elected by 11% or 9% of Angelenos. People were just like, shame on you, Angelenos. You should care more about our city. It wasn't like, oh, we're being taken over by the Reds. You know, right. like there wasn't that same panic. But yeah, I think that as turnout goes up, those same voices might not see the trends that they would like to see, namely the votes shifting more towards a Tracy Park. I totally mea culpa though, because I certainly was one of the people. Actually, Mike Bonin was also one of these people. So maybe I'm not as ignorant as all that. I don't know. Who was expecting and was very surprised by this result. I was expecting to see a more stridently reactionary West Side. Although, you know, we do say like the West Side is more moderate and it does have more conservative voices compared to other parts of the city. It also has been a progressive stronghold for a long time. Mm-hmm. So what I was expecting, yes, what you would certainly be expecting if you paid attention to blue check accounts on Twitter or the TV news or anything like that, was that a lot of that progressive support had been eroded away either through the gentrification of neighborhoods like Venice, and Mar Vista and Palms, et cetera. It goes on, or by the fact that things had gotten so terrible and Bonin's leadership had been so unchecked in its progressive excesses that they were being forced, that voters were being forced to the center. And that clearly has been repudiated. That obviously has not been the case.
Yeah. And Bonin had a great thread about this just the other day on Twitter. He's actually been cranking out tons of threads that have had some good analysis, but it's particularly about West Side trends, which I thought was very good. One more race we'll talk about that has a similar trend, the through line, I guess, to these two is CD13, where we saw another incumbent getting walloped, I would say, when you look at money flowing to the race. We had Mitch O'Farrell only got 32% of the vote. And a vast field of challengers managed to, you know, claw away votes from the incumbent when he was also receiving tons of money from these same, you know, the same, the Holy like Trinity or whatever.
There was
literally like a pack. There were multiple packs actually that like had the same groups of pro police,
and that they lumped in Gil and Mitch in their spending.
Yes, yeah, and some of these were a lot of overlap. So we had landlords, labor, and police, kind of jumping in against some of these challengers. And what did we see in 13? I'm going to throw it back to Scott again because he had some great analysis, I think, of particularly where the votes came from for these opponents.
Mama's little Mitch watcher. That's my role. Oh, no. So, I mean, the thing that happened here that I think was not surprising is that Mitch did not finish in first in this race. I think that there were many people, myself included, who thought it was entirely within the realm of possibility that Hugo Soto Martinez could win in the primary. That
and he was 41%. So
that would have been a lift. Anyway, with the number of people in this race. That being said, one of the things that I have very loudly talked about for a number of years is that Mitch O'Farrell is so far at odds in terms of his record, in terms of his ideology, in terms of the apparent disdain that he has for constituents. I am one of his constituents, and has been for so long, right? Like that it seemed like this district in particular was on pace for a correction. I looked at the data from 2020 and I made a list where I was like, oh, you know, CD 13 and 1 and 9 are all, I think, gettable. Obviously, CD 9 did not flip in this election, but CD 13 and 1 and 9 are all gettable because they have so many voters who in the presidential primary are going for not just progressive Democratic presidential candidates, but Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, both of whom are, I would say, the furthest left Democratic candidates that the party has had in a generation, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, regardless of of which one of those two you picked, it certainly indicates that you are perhaps somebody who is ready for a change in political leadership style. And by that particular metric, CD13 stands far out above every, you know, like two-thirds or more of voters in that district voted for one of the progressive candidates. And then you have their local representation in CD13, which is Mitch O'Farrell, somebody who literally brought in a military, militarized police force, 400 cops in the dead of night to break protesters' arms, shove people around, and put unhoused people in an open air prison, which they did. And then they left that fence up for, well, it's actually still up in large part.
I tripped over it yesterday trying to use the sidewalk on a perimeter of Echo Park Lake.
Yeah, it's very ADA accessible, which was the stated purpose. But yeah, no, he's somebody who has shown he is really willing to use the raw exercise of power to tell people who live in his district, this is not your district, this is my district, you just live here. A message that seemingly did not resonate well with the voters of CD13. And so we have in the first three slots, we have third, Kate Pinus, we have second, Mitch O'Farrell, and first, Hugo Soto Martinez. So Hugo and Mitch now go to a runoff, one in which I think I would say Soto Martinez is heavily favored to win. Kate Pinus, those were mostly, I would say, in all likelihood, anti-Mitch votes. And she did well in new parts of the district as well, including in Hancock Park. There, you know, Mitch actually did his best performance in the newly redistricted parts of CD13.
So parts that used to be CD4, mm-hmm. and maybe 5 in a couple instances.
Parts that he really wanted, yeah, added to CD13,
yeah,
for obvious reason. Yeah. Although, I mean, his independent appointed representee on the redistricting commission wanted them for reasons that had nothing to do with Mitch's electoral future, of course.
And since you brought up the lake, I found this very interesting, talking to Scott the other day, that after all that, the precincts around the lake did not go to O'Farrell. So
yeah,
after mm-hmm. all of that.
That feels like a bellwether,
yeah,
to me. Like you take a look at the precincts surrounding Echo Park Lake, and they went to Hugo in large part. And that seems like, you know, the lake was a Hail Mary of incredible repression. Mm-hmm. Just like, we're going to steamroll over you. And again, you know, like there was this suspicion, this folk wisdom among the political class, that the people who were mad about the way that things were going in City Hall were just the loudest voices. Mm-hmm. And to take a page out of Nixon's book, the silent majority supported what Mitch O'Farrell was doing. Right. And so, you know, Mitch strapped on his jack boots and he brought all of the cops in the world out to Echo Park Lake, and just, you know, just stomped down on everybody. And you will be thanked for it later. You will be welcomed as, yeah, liberators. And Echo Park Lake seems to be the death of that argument as well. Mm-hmm. Mitch O'Farrell just posted on Twitter that he feels optimistic going into November, which answers a question that I had, which was, do they know that they are cooked, or are they in extreme denial? And it appears that they're in extreme denial, which should surprise no one, I suppose.
Well, if they didn't come out, the silent majority didn't come out to vote for you in the primary, which is what we're always told, that the most reactionary, mm-hmm, Republican right-wing people vote in every single election, including the primaries. We didn't see that in CD11, and we didn't see that in CD13. So what's going to be their excuse in November with a national election? Granted, it's a midterm, but it's still a national election.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe that's a good way to just quickly go through these last two we're gonna breeze through some of the last other races, but for example, in CD5 we have a runoff with a very more reactionary, I guess, of the candidates is an accurate way to put it. Sam Yebri and Katie Young Yaroslavsky are going to be facing off. And that, I think, is really no surprise in that district. I don't know. I wasn't surprised by that.
The surprise is that Katie Young Yaroslavsky came within a very narrow margin of winning in the primary.
Yeah.
And I think that I certainly did not expect to see that, but she was incredibly close to pulling that off.
Yeah, she could have coasted through, but almost did, and then the numbers kind of slowly brought her under the 50 mark. And then in CD9, which you mentioned is like a progressive leaning district, but in this instance, Price, the incumbent, won by 66%, and that number was pretty much the same from the very first dump of votes to a challenger there.
Yeah, the interesting thing about CD9, Karen Price running against Dulce Vasquez, who's an education administrator for ASU, somebody I've actually worked with in a volunteer capacity in the past. The interesting thing I thought about that race is that the margin, as you're saying, is actually similar, very similar, to some of the races in city council that we were considering basically uncontested. So CD3, you had Bob Blumenfield running against somebody whose name I can't remember off the top of my head. His name is Scott. I remember that part. And then you have Monica Rodriguez in District 7 running against Elisa Avalos, I want to say. And the margins are very similar, almost indistinguishable from what we previously had considered to be a very competitively run race in Council District 9. And the question, of course, is, how did that happen? How does that happen? How do you have somebody who is, you know, politically very tuned in, who is, you know, good candidate material, and have that campaign fall completely flat? I don't know. Do either of you have thoughts? I have some thoughts of my own.
Just from folks, I was reading things online, but also folks I have spoken to in the district just didn't seem to like Vasquez at all, and actually preferred Adriana Cabrera, who was also another candidate in the race.
A write-in candidate.
Yeah. Exactly, a write-in candidate. And even just from Cabrera's platforms that I had read and some things that she had written online, she seemed to be a better fit for the district. And I know that there was some, again, I didn't research this independently, but I believe Vasquez moved to the district very recently, and so some folks don't like that.
Story about that, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you have more
information. There was some, that's the only part I remember.
Yeah, there was some, like, there was some argument about when and whether she was, like, living in the district. A lot of that, I think, rebounds on challengers much more so than... Proof to me that Karen Price lives in Council District 9. Yeah, let me just say that.
Where actually several representatives live.
Proof to me that he lives in his district, and then we'll talk. But yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing to me is I look at that certainly as a missed opportunity. As I said before, CD9, again, one of the far and away one of the most progressive districts in the city, also benefits from something that a lot of districts don't have. I think back to when Nithya Raman was running in Council District 4, which of course is just an incredibly sprawling district. Her team or campaign did an incredible job canvassing all of those doors, but that's challenging and it costs a lot of money to get to those places. Council District 9, by comparison, and then you have things like CD15, which are just comically spread out. CD9, by comparison, I always thought, you know, geographically it's compact. It is extremely overwhelmingly Latino at this point. It does seem like it's open for a progressive candidate to come in and succeed there, but that has not happened. I wonder what it takes to get that done. The candidate that you're talking about, Adriana Cabrera, who ran a write-in campaign, is a good candidate and like had a good campaign several years ago as well. She ran against Curran Price, and I shouted her out at the time as being the only candidate that I had seen on ballot in a city council election seeking to expand the franchise, municipal franchise, to undocumented immigrants, which is something that is also a big deal for me, something that I think we need to do as a city. That being said, I saw lots of people talking on Twitter about how Adriana Cabrera, oh, she's the better candidate. You know, she's a better candidate than Dulce Vasquez. However, I will say, in the 5 years between when she ran against Curran Price in 2017 and when she ran against Curran Price in 2022, she lost support. She wasn't able to get on the ballot the second time. There was no mobilization. Like we were just talking about Erin Darling, right? Being able to show up, get onto the ballot in like a weekend, like a long weekend. Yeah. He decided he was going to run for city council, and then here we are. There's none of that infrastructure around an Adriana Cabrera, or frankly around Dulce Vasquez, who was much more of came through like a much more mainstream channel. But the thing that is interesting to me and is a challenge, I think, for the next cycle is how do we expand that support south of the 10, right? Like if the left, the current guard of the left politics in LA can mobilize these elections on such short notice on the West Side or in Central Los Angeles, but it's just, you can't even get somebody on the ballot in yeah, CD9 right, in South Central. That to me is indicative of problems. And it's not Cabrera's fault and it's not Dulce Vasquez's fault, frankly. I think that that was a major missed opportunity. But again, you know, we're talking about a context in which there's much to celebrate for progressive politics generally. So it feels sort of like, you know, picking at threads a little bit.
Right. And quickly for the last few races, and then we'll talk about the mayoral race. Mm-hmm. CD15, we also had a very strong showing with a progressive candidate, Danielle Sandoval, who is endorsed by the LA Times, pushing Tim McCosker, a longtime Garcetti establishment, you know, port person.
In the group chat, we just call him Ports McMoney.
And he has the backing of the police association as well. They will go to runoff for city controller. I don't think anyone would miss this news that's been kind of been talked about everywhere, from Twitter to the LA Times. Kenneth Mejia, who you have seen the corgis prancing across the city. There's new posters and yard signs already up. Basically clobbered Paul Caretz, 43-24. They will go to runoff, but wow. And then in city attorney, we had really a nail biter. This one was like a down to the last few dozen votes with the last certified results. Fassel Gill got 24%, and then Heidi Feldstein Soto barely got second, and literally a few dozen votes separated her from Marina Torres. So Feldstein Soto and Gill go to the runoff there. Now let's talk about what happened in the mayoral race, because I saw this very spectacular celebration that occurred at the Grove.
Girl, I was trying to go though, sorry.
On election night. You were trying to go to the Grove on election night? You were like, I need to go.
I was texting you like, okay, I know he's awful.
Mm-hmm.
But would I go to this party?
Yes, yeah, it was spectacular. They closed up part of the Grove. The confetti was relentless, and he basically declared victory when the first round of results came in. Did we even say his name yet? His name is Rick Caruso. He is a billionaire developer of the Grove and other properties. And it looked for both to the observers at the Grove and to the New York media landscape that this was a strong message being sent to the city when he clocked in just a few percentage points over Bass on that first night.
Big pre-write energy.
Yeah, there was
in the room.
Absolutely.
But the story very quickly shifted, almost as quickly as the confetti was swept away from the fountain area.
And can you imagine?
Caruso's
not paying those guys enough.
There were still people who could see like confetti in the cracks of the rocks like days after. I was like, it just a bad decision. Bass actually ended up getting 43% once all the votes were in. And I was not surprised by this. I kind of thought that this is about the number that we were going to end up with. And I also thought that there was going to be this moment where everybody thought for sure that Caruso was going to win.
You were panicking that Caruso was going to win outright at one point.
Yeah, I was worried about that at first. And then I started to see, you know, the way it ended up was like more a true reflection of perhaps what these other things we've seen in these other council districts. Like what actually happened was this same thing. Like the police spent a lot of money and this person also spent a lot of his own money to try to do this, to try to get this result. And Bass spent a lot less money and she did end up actually edging him out.
This is a situation where, I mean, people don't like thinking about it this way, but this is a situation where it's a progressive victory just not having Rick Caruso beat Bass and sit in the mayor's office. Like that, just not having him present in the city government is a victory. It's a small victory, but we're talking about somebody who as recently as probably yesterday morning with his breakfast said broken windows policing is good. He says it all the time. He loves talking about how a completely discredited philosophy of policing is something that LA needs desperately to return to. He's a dangerous person. He's extremely dangerous, and we would be in bad shape if he were to win. But like the thing is, as we get a little bit more distance between now and primary day, that what he was banking on is actually pretty tough to accomplish. Like you have to think that the mainline Democrats, like just like the party line Democrats who are large in number in LA City, are so fed up with what the elites at the top of the party are telling them to do that they're going to go hard right. Like that's basically the expectation. And that no one on the left is going to show up. And that just didn't happen. Like Karen Bass has a much easier path to victory. It's that Rick Caruso is toxic, is basically radioactive, and you just bet on the rump of the Democratic Party doing what it does, which is, you know, getting a mailer from everyone in the universe saying, vote for Karen Bass. That's a lot easier.
And two things I want to go over. One is the money itself. You know, much has been said about how much of his own money he put into it. $37.5 million of his own money. He did not raise that much actual money from people. It was probably only about $750,000.
Who are those marks?
Who are those? One of them was Reince Priebus, the chief of staff
of Trump.
Julia Wick tweeted that the other day. So you know where that money's coming from. And then celebrities, I guess. Like, I don't know. He had his like five celebrity base. Did she even give money, though? The celebrities who don't actually live in LA in most cases. He got $3.5 million spending from the police. And all of that could not even get him the higher percentage. He got him to the runoff, of course. But again, Karen Bass ended up being close to almost getting it in 50.
At Caruso's spin world, this becomes, we didn't want to be in first. We didn't think we were going to be in first. Yeah. We only thought that we would get, we're going to be what in the runoff, prayer. Which is such, yeah, yeah exactly. Just a, it was just a Hail Mary.
Hail Mary, like a 37.
Small town kid stepping up to the plate.
Just giving it all we've got. So yeah, now they're the underdog. And what's interesting, and Scott has noted this, is how much the tenor of that campaign has changed.
Yeah.
Just in the days since, the week since the primary was held.
He's mad.
He is posting like these videos of people, you know, unhoused people having crises in the street, and just, you know, using the same thing as all these accounts do, where they're just like, this is how bad LA is, mm-hmm. you know, who's going to save us? And that is now the new approach.
Yeah, the pre-primary, it was like, you know, Rick Caruso, he's like the jolly green giant. He's so smiley and everybody's going to be, I don't know, everybody's going to be so happy in his LA. He just needs to take us back to a time where everybody was his grandparents and we all had $20 in our pocket and we were all happy anyway. And then after the primary, it's fuck you guys. What do you don't see how shitty this place is?
How dare you
not vote for me?
There's a
naked
city.
Guy dancing on a car over here. Are you fucking stupid? Vote for Rick. it was like an immediate change. He's furious now.
Yeah, and again, these real big like social issues that are on the national stage. You know, we have abortion now. Mm-hmm. Who thought we'd be talking about abortion access, you know, in 2022? Yeah. We had a serious gun violence conversation happening at the national level. He is inequipped to deal with these, and the overriding climate conversation, I think, as well. He is inequipped to deal with these from his longtime Republican support that he has given to these candidates and these causes to actually do the opposite of what is trying to, you know, causing these huge chaos, moments of chaos on the national scale, at the national scale. So he puts out these messages after, say, you know, people, a bunch of children are shot in their classrooms, or, you know, Roe v. Wade is revoked. And it's kind of still this like both sides mentality. Like,
what? Well, I mean, and think about it, because as much as he wants, and as much as it's so funny when Rick Caruso pre-primary again, anytime he would post anything, people would be like, I can't believe you're not a Republican anymore, blah, blah, blah. Like, what are you doing? And then somebody else would be like, you know, Pepe the Frog comes in underneath them and is like, well, don't you get it? He's just a quote unquote Democrat. We're just tricking the libs. While I'm like, yeah, we can see all of this, right? But that was the conversation that conservatives were having about Rick Caruso. And then subsequently, you know, we have all this stuff, like you're saying, all these federally spurred conversations that Rick Caruso cannot win at. One was about protecting trans rights. Caruso is saying, I support trans rights. I always blah, 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 whatever. I'm great. I've always been great. And underneath all of these posts, every single one of them, the gun control one, the abortion one, you have a litany of people being just like, you've lost my vote. Why are you pandering to these lefty lunatics?
And then you click on the bio and it's like Iowa. But yes.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure.
But yes, I mean, it is like, it's you've lost your base for sure, because you've tried too hard to make yourself look like you're a moderate Democrat, which you never really were, and then your record gets you in a lot of trouble, and also your old allegiances. I mean, I don't see a pathway for a win now, although I was so terrified in the early moments of the campaign. But like, what do you do now? Spend like $100 million to try to, like, I mean, I don't know what you do at this point.
He's like, basically like a water balloon that's just getting pricked, like tiny pin pricks, and he's just gonna like be a shriveled up empty water balloon by the time we get to November.
Maybe like a fountain metaphor. Sure. Like it's slowly So, and just to, and one last thing that must be mentioned in the mayoral race, KDL, Kevin DeLeon, we do not, we never really heard from him. We never knew what he stood for. He didn't
Kevin DeLeon, we barely knew you.
We barely knew you. And it doesn't matter because he's going to go run for lieutenant governor or something now. So
back to the state.
We won't even probably see much more of him here. He ended up coming in at about 7% with just not very much to show for it. Gina Viola, on the other hand, again, a very late entry to the race, came in on the last day possible. She raised, you know, the amount of money that, like, Rick Caruso, like, throws in a garbage can at the end of the year because the money looks old. And
when they sweep the floors of the Grove at the end of the day, because pennies and cash are not allowed at the
it's
Grove.
It's the change that's in the fountain. Yeah. They clean out of that. She ended up spending $1.16 per vote. She came in with a high 6% of the votes. Many precincts in the most progressive part of the city. She came in second under Bass. Like, really, like an amazing showing for another abolitionist candidate who was amazing at a lot of these debates too, at pushing some of these issues that were not getting discussed. And now there's a whole conversation about how much can Bass actually be pushed to the right. She wrote this very great letter after the primary, just saying, like, you know, we are giving you an opportunity to come more to the left on some of these issues, things like 4118, which is the anti-camping ban, things like police brutality and support of police, and do we really need to increase the police force, things like that. So again, we will see what happens over the next few months, but this was another, like, I think, shocking to the mainstream
established class.
Shocking to the establishment. But really, really amazing and dramatic race, I think, in the ends of the last few weeks there.
I can only imagine what it's like at LA Mag headquarters these days. Just the weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Let's talk about some of those takes, if you will. There was not just, I think the great thing about the next morning was just watching, like you said, the pre-writes landing on, you know, the Twitter trending topics. And it was unfortunate that what was happening in LA with these very early Caruso wins vibes was what happened in San Francisco, which was actually maybe a bit of a reactionary narrative that you could kind of lump all these things together in. But it turned out to be not actually the case. The one very, cringe-inducing headline that I saw was, "Is this the end of the George Floyd moment?" That ran on the Atlantic. What was your reaction to a headline like that?
A weary nation tells black people to die somewhere else.
Exactly.
Die quietly, please. I don't know. It's these types of headlines, there were many of them, and a lot of them came from the East Coast press. That seemed like they were looking for this to be the culmination of narratives that they had begun pushing months and months ago. Instead of talking about things like the obstinacy, frankly, of the existing electoral classes in cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles, you would have to have actually some familiarity with the local politics, and enough familiarity that you don't routinely write articles like the New York Times does, where it's like, "These guys are all Democrats. Why are they all mad at each other?" a little bit more familiarity with than that. Like, they were looking at this as the culmination of a narrative that they had started pushing, that was everyone is sick of protests, of disruptions to normal social life, of quality of life concerns that we, very rich people, take for granted. And there's a disconnect there, not only between, you know, the cities where these stories are being written and the cities that they're about, but also a disconnect between perhaps the both ridership and readership of those stories and the people who live in Los Angeles. It's a very complicated city to try and write about if you don't attempt to understand it, frankly. And the fact of the matter is Los Angeles is full of people who are routinely beaten down by the normal social order. So it shouldn't entirely surprise us that the George Floyd moment does not end. It continues here. And yet, you know, we do have a political class that has really attempted to staunch the flow of any sort of progress coming out of it.
Yeah, all of these articles were opinion pieces. They should have been written from the like first person perspective. I want the George Floyd moment to be over. I want to stop thinking about Black people and other people of color being killed because I do not care. And it is bothering me in the same way that I don't want to wear a mask. So the pandemic is over. It's all the same thing. And it should be illegal to write about Los Angeles if you do not live here. I am sick of reading these takes. That's what I'll run on when I am running for mayor. But it was just really frustrating to see because we all knew that there were going to be multiple ballot dumps, as we're calling them, coming. So night one is never it in and of itself. Yet all of these pre-writes were coming out like, see, LA is just as bad as we are. And it's like, no, we're actually still trying here. We're actually still trying to stifle the careers of bad people. We're actually still trying to call people out for their bullshit. Just because you all gave up over there doesn't mean that we did. And I took it very personally, obviously. But it's racism. Like, that's all that it is. I think people want to pretend like Los Angeles is not an extremely diverse place. And they're writing it from that first person perspective. And they're usually, you know, very privileged white writers writing these articles. So I'm over it. Stop doing it, please. We don't care.
Perfect way to sum it up. So now we find ourselves in an interesting moment after San Francisco's recall of their DA. Our recall is going to get national attention because they may have enough signatures. The recallers of George Gascon have turned in what they believe are enough signatures to get a recall election triggered. Scott is not completely convinced that they will have enough signatures.
They have a lot of signatures, and I think they said they submitted the most signatures for anyone ever doing this in LA County. Probably true. I also just think when somebody submits, I think they ended up with just 125% of the total that they were supposed to get. You should expect and start planning for there to be a recall election. But that being said, like, everybody does think there's like a buffer that you need to have because signatures get thrown out. I think the conventional wisdom there is it's like 25 to 33%. That, you know, they're right there. They're at the very bottom end of that. So it depends.
Yeah. And then also part of that trend, I think, which was, as we're talking about, say, what judges can and cannot do on the federal level, we had a slate of four progressive women defenders who were running for LA Superior County judge positions under the Defenders of Justice title. And they all four went to runoff, which is, again, like showing how you can make serious changes to the way our courts work, starting at the very lowest level, and making sure that those types of people are making their way up. And
honestly, the story of this election is in Los Angeles is that the local left organizing apparatus that we have here that really started kicking into gear after the 2016 presidential election seems to be maturing and running circles around more traditional organizing apparatuses.
That's not what the traditional apparatus hostesses say when no. they are in private luncheon events.
Well, they wouldn't, would they?
Well, in one particular story that it came from the calls coming from inside the house with Los Angeles Magazine that you referenced earlier.
They don't receive outside calls. The calls are always coming from inside the house.
But this is a very interesting, and I really wish there would have been some video of this, but interestingly, there is not, of a luncheon with Councilmember Paul Krikorian, who you would remember was rumored to be someone that was going to become interim mayor in the instance that Mayor Eric Garcetti would have to depart the city for some reason, perhaps being confirmed as the ambassador to India, which has not happened. It is the 1 year anniversary of that nomination, and that has still not occurred. And you wonder if Krikorian is just maybe upset that he never got his time to shine as the interim mayor.
He was a contender.
He was going to be a contender.
He could have been somebody instead of being a bum, which is what he is, a bum. I'm sorry. That
he made a comment to kind of leave this left organizing apparatus that you're talking about it should not be taken seriously. These people have not held office before. He said, leave it to the professionals, to which many people were eager to point out what the professionals have done for us over the last decade.
We call this a lost decade, right? The 2010s, the complete abdication of leadership mm-hmm. by professional leaders like Paul Krikorian. Although I can't even say he's among the worst of them. He seems at least to be competent at what he does. And sometimes that's a relief because there are so many people who aren't. But yeah, no, like the professional leadership class has squandered time that we do not have while things are rapidly falling apart in Los Angeles. And the invocation to everyone listening who are the most insidery of insiders you could possibly imagine, like it's what lobbyists and lawyers and their friends have having this lunch together with politicians. So it's a big thing that they do every month where they get together and they talk about how much power they have and how great the stake is and et cetera. By the way, it's not eco-friendly either, Paul. Put down the steak.
I think it was actually like salmon.
They were at the, okay, yeah. They were at the Palm, but they were not having the steak. Got it. But yeah, no, like the call to the insiders that like we are in danger. We are an endangered species, professional leaders, and the city's going to tear itself apart because all of these people want to. The analogy that Krikorian used was that he thinks that all of the people on the left are like people who just come to play pool for the first time and they try and hit the billiards balls as hard as they can in the hopes that even one of them will go in. So it's a very condescending analogy, one that was ripe for being picked up by LA Mag. It is actually their bread and butter, this kind of story. So I mean, I wasn't aware that they had enough reporters to staff every political luncheon in Southern California. I thought they just had two, and one of them was the guy who spends all of his time going through Nika Soon-Shiong's old tweets, which is a full-time gig. So, you know, but their one guy then who wasn't busy being on Twitter happened to be at this luncheon, and I think that that's wonderful. I think it's great. I love it when somebody gets a lucky break like that, and God bless them, really.
And in that kind of echoing many of the things from that story, Steve Lopez wrote a column this week in the LA Times, which was kind of giving credit to the organizing skills, perhaps, but also, I think, very firmly leave it to the adults kind of. What do you think, Rachel?
Like, first of all, we're in our 30s and 40s now. So, like, if I'm old enough to have debt, I'm old enough to run for office and win. So that's that out of the way.
But do you want to announce something? I'm really hearing this.
I am not running. I'm just baffled by this notion that people, or folks like Steve Lopez and Krikorian, think that people want professional politicians in office. Yeah. Like this idea that that is what people are voting for, when it's been proven, as Scott said, over the last 6 years, that we don't want that. Yeah. Like, we want professional organizers in office. We want single parents in office. We want people who live the experiences that we are living in the city that has been destroyed by the professional class.
That's right.
And professional politicians, because the closer you are to the problem, the more apt you are to solve it. And I am just like, I mean, I know why Steve Lopez is the way that he is. I've read enough of his articles to kind of understand that, but it was so offensive and rude. All of this is like, we don't want you anymore. Like, that is the whole point. That is why we are turning over the city council, because you have failed. And that's fine. Take your lobbyists and go. We want people who are like us in office now, because we can try at least to solve the problem. Yeah. Because they're not even trying to solve our problems right now.
We had so many amazing reminders of how the current government has failed us over the last few weeks since we've been on hiatus. We had the first of the Huizar trials go to court and found the developer, David Lee, guilty of basically the first step of a very large plot that actually dramatically affected the city. And we still don't know the depths of how much damage has actually been done. We had the many developments in the DWP scandal. We have more people who are going to be indicted, sentenced as part of that. And again, we still do not know the full damage that has been brought to the city through that. And we also found out just in the last few weeks that Rick Jacobs, who is at the center of another scandal that's gone all the way to the top, in this instance is preventing the city from having a different leader in this time. The mayor is still here. He has been paid by the Carpenters Union over the last year to work on some of these, electing some of these people and keeping them in council, or trying to bring other Garcetti loyalists into this fold. And again, like, that trial is going to be happening at the same time in 2023, the same time that Huizar himself is going to be in federal court. We have a lot more coming before we actually even know how bad it has been. And like you said, this lost decade, this 10 years of, you know, where did, are we better than we were when we started?
Maybe. There's a bridge now.
That's a great thing to bring it back to.
There was a bridge before.
There's a different bridge.
Don't bother. Ignore the bridge.
But what are the foundations built upon, Scott? It is protected from earthquakes, though. There are base isolators, so that
we can all go to the bridge for an earthquake.
But will it collapse under?
Under the weight of all the tap dancers.
And on that note, we do not know when we'll see you again, but we hope to see you again soon. Thanks again for everything that you have expressed in the form of support, and for sharing what we do. We will talk to you again soon. Goodbye.
I wonder what is going on here. Is this space hell or is it paradise? And will we make it worse or make it nice? What's the forecast tonight?